Welcome to the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And our guest is Luke Francis Byrne. And by the way, he's the author of a novel coming out, published by Baraka Books, Fox Hunt. And we look forward to talking, by the way, about that. But Luke, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Phil.
You've written a very timely piece. Everybody's very nervous about the situation developing in Ukraine, Russia. Title of the article is Echoes of Cold War, NATO Aggression and Ukraine, published on the 14th at, I guess it's nbmediacoop.org. I really urge people to go and find this article. I have to ask you, the thesis of your article is that maybe if you were following Western media, you would be convinced that Putin is a Machiavellian, a bully, and we can't really read his mind, but we have to be prepared. But your article stresses that probably for our own safety here in the West, we ought to be looking a little more closely at NATO. And of course, Canada is deeply involved. You start off with a quote from Chrystia Freeland. She says this is a contest between democracy and authoritarianism. Tell us what you make of that and how the framing of this issue.
Well, I really think that that's going back to the Cold War binary, you know, the idea of democracy versus totalitarianism. She uses the phrase authoritarianism as well. But it's interesting to me that she completely ignores one of the great nuclear armed powers that she's referring to in her criticism. You know, so she talks about nuclear armed powers having the ability to redraw borders. But NATO, you know, Canada is a NATO member. And NATO is a greater nuclear power than Russia is. So any critique of nuclear armed powers redrawing borders should also focus on NATO. And I think in terms of Canadian media, the focus should be more so on NATO than on Russia.
Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah, and on that point, I mean, here we are listening to Biden and to Secretary Blinken, of course, the British. They're all using a really worrying kind of language. They say, well, we think that Russia is going to establish a false flag. It struck me that if you yourself was considering false flag, a good thing to do would be to say your opponent is organizing a false flag.
It's a very strange thing to say, particularly because they had no evidence to back that up that I've seen. You know, they haven't ever come out and said, this is why we think that. It's just, you know, we have intelligence to suggest that Russia is going to start a false flag operation and then, you know, launch an invasion based upon that. But it's just a very strange way to go about things, you know.
It sort of sets a trap, doesn't it? I mean,
it does, yeah.
Actually, for example, I want you to go into this matter too. We know that this area, southeast Ukraine, called the Donbass, there's actual fighting has been going on there for a number of years. And we're hearing about a flare up of fighting there. That's not the overriding theme. The overriding theme is all those Russians. But somebody's starting to put a lot of violent pressure on the borders of Donbass. Mm. And so if the people of Donbass were to fire back, I assume that the Americans would tell us that's a false flag.
Yeah, and I think that that's one of the key things is that really in Ukraine, the sense that I've been getting is that Ukrainians are saying they've been at war with Russia since 2014, that what's going on is nothing particularly new, you know. And obviously it's a civil war as well. But the idea that there's all of a sudden a a surge in Russian activity on the border seems to be misconstrued, you know, that there's a media storm in the West suggesting that there's a surge, but we don't necessarily know that that's the case. The forces that are on Ukraine's borders right now are the same forces that were brought out when NATO did its defense Europe or European defense exercises. I can't remember the term there, but NATO forces had about 28,000 troops on Russian borders, and Russia brought troops in as well. And it wasn't a matter of concern at that time. So I don't know why the presence of troops now is necessarily a matter of concern.
Mm-hmm. You know, the article you wrote, and again, I want to make sure you identify that it's nbmediacoop.org. You describe elements of Ukraine that, again, do not get discussion here, but are certainly highly pertinent to what the latest news, which Canada went from saying they weren't going to provide lethal weapons to now providing them.
Yeah.
And other NATO countries are providing weapons. And your article points out that there are organizations, particularly along military organizations, along that border with Lugansk and Donbass, that are very unsavory. Again, it's not mentioned, one of them being the Azov battalion. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So I think that's one of the most concerning elements of this whole situation. Right now, there's a battalion that's part of the National Guard called Azov, and it's explicitly a neo-Nazi group. And it's receiving training and support from Western NATO forces. The group is actually grown since it started receiving this support. So that tells me that this support is contributing to the resurgence of militant Nazism in Ukraine, which is something that Canadian media should be examining pretty closely.
Yeah. Wasn't that, my memory was that we even had a kind of an embarrassing incident where Canadian Army officers had met Azov Brigade people, but they played it down, or they went to some trouble to get the media not to talk about that. Again, it's part of this thing where here they're saying, well, we want to defend Ukraine, but the kinds of weapons they're providing go directly not to defense, but to fighting groups that are threatening Donbass.
Yeah. And another, you know, you can call it an embarrassing incident, but it hasn't been an embarrassment yet, at least publicly. But on the 13th of February, CBC republished an Associated Press article that featured an image of a elderly 79-year-old lady holding an assault rifle. And that image was taken from an Azov battalion propaganda photo shoot. And there's been no mention of that. And the image itself in the article was cropped, so you can't see the patches on the soldier's arm. But I've seen other images where you can see the Azov patch right on the arm of the soldiers. So, you know, that's something that needs to be critiqued pretty severely, I think, in Canadian media, that how is this being supported, and why, you know?
Yeah, and also speaks to the problem of propaganda in media that, you know, ordinarily, if you write to the paper and say, by the way, there's now ample evidence that that was Azov battalion, are you going to publish a correction? There's been no correction that I'm aware of.
There has been no correction, no. And it's an interesting example considering the Freedom Convoy that's ongoing, and that, you know, I think that there's good criticism of the convoy and the Nazi elements, neo-Nazi elements, white supremacist elements, and that. But if the media can criticize that, but is unable to criticize a much more serious Nazi militant threat in a region that experienced some of the worst atrocities of the Holocaust. You know, and the Holocaust was, it really wasn't that long ago. And that's the worst thing that's ever happened in history, more or less, right? So it's just shocking that it's not being addressed.
Yeah. But that has, you know, we've had this issue for some time with, you know, it wasn't a secret. I remember when John McCain from Arizona and Senator, he was at the Maidan Square and he was standing alongside known anti-Semites, major, by the way, major figures. I'm not saying they're fringe. Those guys are major figures in Ukrainian politics.
Yeah, but
McCain had no problem with that. Our media, this is a dangerous time to let us all down, right?
It is, yeah. This is, and like you said, it's not anything new. What I think is somewhat more concerning now is just the scale of the resurgence in Ukraine. You know, this particular battalion has a political party. It has summer camps that train kids. It has, you know, connections with global neo-Nazi circles. It has a headquarters that it leases from Ukrainian National Guard, and that headquarters houses lecture halls, you know, teaching propaganda and so on. And in the West, when this is brought up, it's called, you know, Nazi or Russian disinformation, different things like that. And really, I'm sure to an extent, Putin is drawing on these threats and manipulating them for his own uses within Russia and whatever else. But to suggest that this isn't a real threat is just ridiculous, you know? And particularly in Ukraine, because it's an issue that will be of particular concern to Eastern Europeans, you know, during the Holocaust when 1.2, 1.6 million Jewish people were murdered in Ukraine. These were Eastern European people. So this is something that will be remembered, you know, within Russia, within Ukraine.
Yeah, I wish more people would point out that those with whom Ottawa is now aligned seem to be rather proud of having been allied with an army that we fought.
Yeah.
Yeah. After we were, there was a time in Canada we were quite proud of our Russian ally and delighted that they were enjoying success. And here we are comfortably standing alongside people who actually literally their fathers and were fighting us.
Yeah.
That's taken, of course, that has to do with the unfolding of the Cold War. Your article takes this up. By the way, we're speaking to Luke Barron. He's got a new novel coming out, Fox Hunt. And of course, we're discussing today the article that appeared in the NB, I'm going to pull it up, the NBmediacoop.org. Discuss that matter of the Cold War, which you explain very nicely in the article, how we got to where we are now.
Yeah, well, I think that that's one of the things in Ukraine that needs to be understood is, I'm not suggesting either that Russia is a benevolent country, you know. I think that Russian actions are imperialist in that the Russian state has a lot of repressive action. But I think in this situation, Russia's reacting to constant NATO expansion over the last 30 years. You know, the past 30 years have seen NATO expand 800 miles to the east, and they've added 14 new Eastern European countries to NATO. And there was specifically, they specifically promised not to do that at the what was supposed to be the end of the Cold War. My belief is really that the Cold War didn't end, more or less, that the Cold War was practices, dispositions, and behaviors. It wasn't a conflict necessarily between two powers. It was a, Becky Schrinkelper has a phrase, she says, the afterlife of European colonialism. And I think that that's accurate, that it's a struggle for regions of extraction, struggle to take power, you know, more or less over colonial regions.
Mm-hmm. On that line, the world does seem to be going through a kind of a tectonic shift again at the moment, because as you point out, the former colonial countries had achieved or have achieved a degree of independence and the control over the resources. And certainly that's their desire.
Yeah.
And here we are in a moment where many of them are resuming ties with the former Soviet Union, now Russia, because frankly, they have their own economic interests. They would like some protection against this kind of neo-colonial exercise, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think that that's when countries got political independence or apparent political independence, they didn't necessarily get economic independence, and those chains of extraction were maintained or were even strengthened. You know, for instance, when Indonesia became independent from the Dutch, America spent a huge amount of money on so-called modernization efforts in Indonesia, and they built universities, they built schools, and then they sent over economists to, you know, train students. And they bolstered the economic development of Indonesia to retain control, more or less, that it would be a region of extraction still. And that was the general practice in the post-war years, that former imperial powers, colonial powers, were in ruins in a lot of cases. And America was in a position of power that's almost unparalleled historically. And so it managed to kind of take over control of these chains of extraction. The sphere of accumulation in Europe was bolstered. And because America was in such a position of control over a lot of these European countries as they were redeveloping, it managed to gain control of their colonial subjects, you know, more or less.
Mm-hmm. NATO, too. Some of the part of the rhetoric today is, well, you know, here we are, we might even actually have a conflict in armed conflict in Europe. President Putin of Russia says, well, you did that already. You did it in Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
And that was you. What's he talking about there?
Well, I don't know the specifics of the Yugoslav situation, you know, too well, so I don't want to dive into that too much. You know,
it was a NATO states bombing, right?
It was, yeah. Yeah.
I think you say in the article that there was that NATO has been involved in 70 coups.
Yeah, and
that's a lot of overthrowing of government.
It is, and most of those are what they call covert. You know, there's a covert and overt, and there's some overt overthrowings, but a lot of the time, NATO's American state forces are behind the scenes working with anti-government forces, more or less, to install elements that are more favorable for their own economic interests.
Yeah, you mentioned, of course, you discuss the Iran, and you give two instances of. That first one was, of course, the removal of a democratically elected president, Mossadegh, and but really a shocking one of only 2 years ago, of the assassination of a very high-ranking Iranian leader who was in a third country, Iraq, on a diplomatic mission, and nobody in NATO complained that was outright murder. I mean,
that's a situation where if the tables were turned, I can't even imagine what would happen if the tables were turned, you know, and I don't know, there are some situations where Trump is blamed, and it's really just the American state doing what it's always done, you know. But that's a situation where I don't know that would have happened under another leader, because it is so blatant to specifically target a figure like that. And it's not even necessarily worse than targeting just your average person, because, you know, a life's a life. But at the end of the day, it's a statement, you know. It's
if a sitting president of a so-called democratic country boasts that he killed someone, who was a national leader in another state, and no one can bring themselves even to cough or interrupt or ask a question.
No, there's no criticism of that, but there's
NATO seems to be run by terror, by the way, doesn't it? I get the impression that Canadians are petrified of Washington.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of criticism of Trump's ties to Russia, Trump's ties, you know, Russian disinformation leading to his election and everything else, you know, meddling in American politics. But the fact that America was willing to assassinate a political figure from another country is overlooked entirely. You know, it's ridiculous, really.
Yeah, those are what Christopher Freeland calls that our values or something.
Our values, the international rules based order. You know,
rules based order, and our values, which involves looking the other way while somebody is publicly murdered. We're speaking to Luke Barron, and Luke. We have a government in Kyiv that is being treated as a fully sovereign government with authority over, you know, Ukraine. Yeah. But the group that is running Ukraine today, the parties, whichever ones they are, they're the result of a coup, are they not? I think you discussed that point.
Yeah, I think that it's important to turn to Ukrainian sources, Ukrainian people, to find out, you know, what the sense there is. But it's difficult because those sources aren't represented in our media. You know, right now it's Western figures talking about Ukraine. But the situation there is definitely, the Maidan movement was co-opted by NATO and Western forces. And whether or not legitimate elements, I suppose there were probably legitimate elements governed out anyway, but that was supported and bolstered by NATO and Western forces for their own interests. Mm-hmm. You know, and there were oligarchic elements as well that were trying to protect their own business interests, because the government in power was drawing closer to Russia rather than drawing closer to the European Union, more or less.
Mm-hmm. It's so striking that I really hope that people's memories are somewhat clear, that Victoria Nuland appeared in Maidan Square, and of course we had the famous recording of her, not denied, she acknowledged, in which she said she named who would be the ministers in a new government after a violent takeover, eliminating this one and that, like they were auditioning for a movie.
Yeah, well, that's the co-option I'm talking about, more or less. That, you know, there was legitimate critique of the state, I think, for repressive acts. People were genuinely angry in a lot of cases, but at the same time, that was fueled by Western elements and it was taken advantage of. And so when it became a parliamentary issue, you know, an issue of government rather than of social movement, it was was Western interest.
Yeah. The core of this at the moment seems to turn on this matter of Donbass, Lugansk. And by the way, until the last week, when I heard Chrystia Freeland or the Prime Minister or the President of the United States, they never mentioned that region. Now they are starting to talk about it, but when with the seizure of power in Maidan, that region, Donbass, had a very serious difference of opinion about where the country was going to go. If we had been listening from the beginning, of course, maybe we wouldn't be in such a situation, but those who seize power seem to want to exercise Western Ukraine authority over the East, which is obviously an ethnic and even religious issue. And there is a formula that no one talks about, Minsk. Could you discuss those things? What is it that people of Donetsk and Lugansk stand for and want?
Well, that's another thing where I don't really frankly have a full understanding of, you know, Ukrainian-Russian nationalisms or relations to speak on that to an extent. But I don't think that there is much question over the fact that people in those regions, you know, there's a lot of Russian support in those regions, that it wasn't at all the same anti-Russian kind of sentiments that was presented in the media here.
Mm-hmm. As you point out in the article, NATO is an expansionist and very aggressive system.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, wasn't there a time when social democrats in this country argued we shouldn't be in NATO? And I mean, you notice, it seems to me a problem that if NATO decides, we have to go along, right? It's like you've joined the gang, you've got the skull and crossbones on your back and the tattoo on your wrist, and you can't quit, right?
Yeah,
shouldn't we think about being independent?
And I think that the question of independence is a key thing, is that NATO is pretending to uphold independence, you know, Ukrainian independence, but really what it is trying to do is exert its own influence over Ukraine. And I think in the UK, you can see this as well right now with the Labour Party, it's gung-ho for NATO support. And I think one of the reasons for that is the Labour Party wants to show that despite Brexit, it still is part of the transatlantic sphere. You know, it still holds the same position. And Canada is part of that sphere as well. And it's not in control, obviously. Canada doesn't have the same influence as the United States, but it benefits from its position of privilege within that sphere, just as the UK does. You know, before the Second World War, the United Kingdom was essentially a stronger force, economic, military. Yes. It was the colonial power. And following the Second World War, America took over. And so that transatlantic sphere was upheld, but America took the mantle more or less.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly an interesting element. I mentioned your thoughts about that, that despite all the new books and new leaders fall back into patterns, the British are once again suggesting there's something wrong with the French, and the Germans, we had a visit here. I don't know if you followed this, but it'd be interesting, again, your thoughts about it. But the defense minister of Ukraine was in Canada about 3 weeks ago, and I was shocked. He was on the first front page of the Globe and Mail, and he said, we need the Anglo-Saxon countries to come in. He said, the French are just interested in being friendly to Russia, and they're pragmatists. And he said, the same is true of Germany. We need the Anglo-Saxons. and I thought, so to him, Anglo-Saxons are not friendly to Russians, and they're not practical. So what is he telling us who we are? We sound like a bunch of barbarians.
Yeah, and I mean, that's... that talk of Anglo-Saxon is serious.
It's coming out of their mouths. I'm really quite surprised.
It is. I haven't heard that quote before, but the Anglo-Saxon civilization, that notion, the notion of upholding Anglo-Saxon progress is very colonial and white supremacist idea, right? And it's, I suppose in Canada specifically, the idea of Anglo-Saxonism, you know, there was the Ku Klux Klan was trying to uphold Anglo-Saxonism. There's, you know, when you see white supremacists today, Proud Boys, all these, they're trying to uphold Anglo-Saxon civilization. And the idea being that civilization was advancing under Anglo-Saxon reign for however many years, and there's been a diversion, you know, that there's elements threatening that now. And so that's very dangerous rhetoric. I haven't heard the specific, you know, quote in question, but it's dangerous.
But they have this... curious thing they call the Five Eyes.
Yeah.
And they don't mention, but you look at it closely, it's Australia, New Zealand, UK, US, and us, Canada.
Yeah.
And they are white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, and a colonial bunch, actually.
Yeah, and
you'd think they'd be a little bit ashamed to even, you know, kind of I was surprised they couldn't think of a more clever way to camouflage who they were. They're almost
out. Yeah, I think that you can see that, you know, America has been at war perpetually since the Second World War, more or less. But when you look at the nations, the states that it's been at war with, you can see, you know, they're not generally speaking white Anglo-Saxon nations. You know, it's these are wars of expansion and extraction, and they don't target, you know, Anglo-Saxon nations. And you can see that also in the just the notion of the European Union, I think, as well, largely it's not necessarily entirely Anglo-Saxon, but the idea of this sphere of support for other like-minded countries. And then you start to question what makes those countries like-minded, and, you know, why are they upholding one another and not other states, you know. And you can see that more or less the imperialist, colonialist, and white supremacist ideas that underlie that.
Yeah, and those countries that suffer the extraction of these Western powers, again, they hear this language.
Yeah,
they're probably not convinced any longer that you consider yourself multicultural.
Yeah, yeah.
my understanding is that the French I forget his name, the one who's now going to go to prison, the former president of the country, said that when he was the president of France, he asked to join the Five Eyes and was refused.
Right.
and you know, that's quite a shame. I would think when the French hear that, they're certainly aware the defense minister of Ukraine said that. You know, if I was their foreign minister, I'd say, well, you don't need me here. I'm going home. I mean, you guys.
Yeah.
This is some kind of gang I should not belong to.
It's very, very strange. That idea as well of extraction and, you know, these countries that are on the receiving end, you know, of NATO and American expansion after Second World War is something that's overlooked, I think, in the Cold War binary that we discussed earlier. You know, we have, in my article, I had that quote from George Kennan, who was the author of the Cold War containment strategy, more or less. And he stated before that, you know, the United States has about 50% of the world's wealth, only 6.3% of its population, and that the disparity there was particularly great between ourselves and the people of Asia. And that the real task of America then is to focus on expanding that and maintaining that position of dominance. And so it's clear there that the disparity between the people of America and the people of Asia is it's Cold War talk, but it's not focused on this anti-communism. It's not focused on maintaining freedom. It's focused on, you know, maintaining dominance over certain particular people.
Yeah. By the way, it does seem the new concept tends to lead more into racialism and what, you know, it's almost an echo of the old anti-Slav thing, which the Western Europe has. That's one of the viruses, political viruses of Western Europe. They historically really, they consider Slavs an inferior people.
Yeah.
I better get you to comment on Minsk. The Russians say, look, you don't even need us now on this. There was an agreement signed, and it was given to the United Nations as the document to solve the problem, the Minsk agreement. It was involved the Ukrainian leadership and I think France, we can mention them again, and some others. And one aspect of it was the government in Kiev has to directly speak to the Donbas states that have been created in resistance to them. And we have Mr. Zelensky says he doesn't have to do that. But that is the basis to solve the problem, isn't it? The people try to turn it into a Russia problem. But they agreed to solve their own problem. That's an internal problem to Ukraine. The people of Donetsk are alienated by these people.
Yeah, it's again another issue where NATO claims to be upholding independence, but it's really not. It's you know, exerting influence. If it really, it doesn't need to be involved in Ukraine. You know, it doesn't need to be protecting Ukraine from Russia in this way, because Russia is really, in this case, responding, I think, to NATO expansion. And so issues within Ukraine are a matter that really should be dealt with by Ukrainian people. You don't need, you know, as Chrystia Freeland said, these nuclear armed powers coming in.
Yeah, they're claiming a sovereignty over a country that they only grabbed part of it and never had a proper election as they had promised.
Yeah.
So in other words, it's a fractured country and they're the ones who fractured it. And yeah. It's taken me a while to get it clear in my head that this is actually not to do with Russia. This is their own internal problem, which the Minsk Accord was a formula for solving it.
Yeah, the Minsk Agreement was, you know, intended to allow for negotiation and peace, more or less. And it's kind of been disregarded, is my understanding.
Mm-hmm. We've been speaking with Luke Francis Byrne. He has a new novel, Fox Hunt. And Luke, you've been very patient with us, and I appreciate your time. Could you give us just an idea so that people go out and grab the book? What is Fox Hunt about?
Well, Fox Hunt is a novel that is set in the Cold War, you know. It's set in the post-war years, and it focuses on the idea of cultural propaganda, largely. It's set in the literary world. I was inspired to write the novel because my research into Congress for Cultural Freedom, Encounter Magazine, which we spoke of earlier, and Perspectives USA, which is another magazine. And just the notion of cultural expansion, there's two planes of power, generally speaking, and when it comes to Cold War, there's military power and then there's everything else. And everything else, you know, is the cultural political power. And so I really wanted to tackle that. But at the end of the day, it is just a novel. It's a literary work focused on characters, and I engage with literature, the literary milieu of the era. I have a literary characters, and the Cold War spy element is kind of peripheral, and it speaks a lot to passivity, you know, how people are involved in things without necessarily actively intending to be, and then how that, the consequences of that, you know.
Mm-hmm. That was an important period. Practically every major writer and artist that we think of, that we know in the West, somehow got tainted or involved and even co-opted.
They really did. And I was thinking that earlier, actually, because when I went on your website, I saw you mentioned Kenneth Rexroth, you know, that you grew up listening to Kenneth Rexroth. But even Rexroth was somewhat tainted, and I don't know to what extent, but he was involved in Perspectives USA, which was a magazine by James Lachlan, which was CIA funded, and he was on the board of advisors for that, which is interesting because Rexroth, you know, considered himself to be, you know, a philosophical anarchist, more or less, right? So, but that's the thing about that era that was so significant, I think, was that people didn't necessarily have to be intending to support American cultural expansion. There were elements that were identified as being helpful, and then they received overwhelming funding, and that funding allowed the certain sentiments and practices and behaviors to become widespread. And it really has reshaped our cultural world. It's reshaped creative writing and literature. It's reshaped music and art. And that's something that people really have to start to reckon with, I think.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that. I had not heard that detail. I knew Mr. Rexroth slightly, had funny run-ins with him, but such people as Rexroth were susceptible. They would be, as you say, he was an anarchist from Chicago originally, and they didn't seem to notice that when they began to let's call it red bait, that somebody put a microphone in front of them, whereas if they hadn't, there wouldn't have been a microphone.
Yeah, that's one of the things that, you know, you don't have to receive instruction from the state. You just have to get their backing, you know. So on that magazine, perspectives, for instance, there was all kinds of people that were involved in it, you know, W.H. Auden, Tennessee Williams, Jonquil Ransom, Francois Bondy, Alan Tate, you know, everybody who you can think of, you know, involved in literature in that era was involved in this.
Well, I'm really glad you're going to have this book, Fox Son, about them, because I seems to me with a novel, you can help us quite a bit because you can get into the psychological issues where people pretend not to know that someone's putting money in their pocket.
Yeah. And
or why.
And how do you turn a blind eye, you know? And how does that look? You know, I'm sure a lot of people who were involved in it didn't even necessarily explicitly know, you know, they didn't want to question it. You know, they didn't want to say, where is this money coming from?
And didn't they go through some of the years of denial when they were was put right under their nose?
Yeah, and claimed that they didn't know. And you know, some of them went to their deathbeds claiming that it couldn't be true, you know. So.
Well, I'm really anxious to read Fox Hunt. And we're speaking to the author, Luke Francis Bairn, when we come to writing. Congratulations on having a new book, and thank you very, very much for your enlightening conversation about the crisis in Ukraine. Let's hope we're all still here in a week to talk about it further. Well,
thank you for having me on.
Thank you very much. This is CIUT, the Tater Report. We'll be right back.